Hi, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Thursday, March 26th, 2026. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey, and today we have three front page articles to start off with. The first one's called Signature Gatherers Force Council Primary. Glendale man charged with murder and cold case, and family tips hat to late Flagstaff legend. And starting at the top of the page, we have, it's called Election 2026, Flagstaff to host first city council primary in 12 years. Mayor's race uncontested as Barrett's again drops bid, by Sam McLaughlin, Sun Staff reporter. Eight prospective candidates for Flagstaff's city council election in November submitted enough signatures to qualify for the ballot ahead of the filing deadline on Monday, March 23rd. Lori Matthews, C.J. Luck, Kara House, Austin Aslan, Drew Stanley, Nancy Baca, Patty Hansen, and Dennis Givens all delivered nominating petitions to the city clerk with more than the required 1,000 voter signatures. Because the number of candidates qualifying for the ballot is more than double the number of available city council seats, three this year, the city must have a primary election in August. Six candidates will advance to the general election. In the mayor's race, only the incumbent, Becky Daggett, filed a complete nominating petition. Former Flagstaff city council member and vice mayor, Celia Barrett's, filed a statement of interest last year, but she ultimately did not provide the requisite petition signatures to challenge Daggett. This is the second time Barrett's has signaled interest in the mayor's seat without actually running for election. In September 2019, she announced her intention to run in 2020, only to publicly withdraw 1 month later. With Barrett's out, Daggett will be the only mayoral candidate whose name appears on the November ballot for a second consecutive election. Barring any surprise showings from write-in challengers, Daggett will likely win re-election to a third two-year term. The last time the city had a primary for city council was in August 2014, when eight candidates were vying for three seats. The city had prepared to hold a primary in 2016, but canceled it after one candidate dropped out of the race. In 2022, the number of city council candidates who qualified for the ballot was only half the number of available seats, the inverse of this year's situation. Mayoral primaries have occurred more recently. At least three candidates sought the mayorship in both 2020 and 2022. The close of the filing period opens the window for potential challenges to the validity of petition signatures. If a voter files a legal challenge to a nominating petition within 10 business days, the county recorder is responsible for overseeing the verification of signatures. The city is not required to proactively verify signatures. This year, the deadline to file a challenge is Monday, April 6th at 5 p.m. Unless someone drops out or is disqualified, the city council primary will take place on August 4th. Half of the field files on last day. Incumbent Councilmember Lori Matthews led the pack this year, filing her nomination paperwork far ahead of deadline on Thursday, March 12th. Matthews submitted 1,372 signatures in total, well above the minimum threshold and the most of any council candidate. Just over a week later, on Friday, March 20th, fellow incumbent House and current Planning and Zoning Commission member Luck submitted collected signatures. House delivered 1,220 signatures, and Luck recorded 1,194. Daggett, too, filed her nominating petition on March 20th. She outdid Matthews in signature count, submitting 1,609. Five of the nine successful nominating petitions arrived on the day of the deadline. Aslan, currently the longest-serving member of the City Council, got his paperwork in by Monday morning. So did first-time candidate Stanley, a Northern Arizona University senior and campus coordinator for the Arizona Students Association. Aslan submitted 1,154 signatures and Stanley 1,235. Baca, director of NAU's Economic Policy Institute, was next to file shortly before noon, with 1,258 signatures. By mid-afternoon, Hansen, the former Coconino County recorder who retired from that role in 2024, had also submitted her nominating petition at 1,202 signatures. Givens was the last candidate to beat the 5 p.m. cutoff. Givens, who previously ran in 2024, collected 1,032 signatures to qualify for the ballot. Prospective candidates who will not appear on the City Council ballot this year include former council member Deborah Harris, who ran successfully as a write-in candidate in 2024, but unsuccessfully in ran successfully as a write-in candidate in 2022, but unsuccessfully in 2024. Sailor Darling, a member of the Coconino County Community Action Advisory Board, and Rachel Costello, a graduate of NAU and employee of the Nature Conservancy. The City Council rotates half of its seats every 2 years. Council members Miranda Sweet, Anthony Garcia, and David Spence won their spots in 2024 and will be up for re-election in 2028. And that election 2026 story was called Flagstaff to Host First City Council Primary in 12 Years, Mayor's Race Uncontested as Barrett's Again Drops Bid. And this was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Moving along to our second front page story, we have an article about crime and courts, and it's titled, Glendale Man Charged with Murder in Decades-Old Flagstaff Cold Case. And this, too, was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. The Coconino County Attorney's Office and Flagstaff Police Department have announced the indictment and arrest of a suspect in an unresolved 1987 murder case. On Thursday, March 19th, a grand jury indicted James Arthur Runnels Jr. on one count of first-degree murder. Runnels, 62, was subsequently arrested on Monday, March 23rd, and booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility. Runnels is accused of killing Ina Claire Langstaff, a 24-year-old Northern Arizona University student stabbed to death outside her apartment on West Tucson Avenue on the morning of November 7, 1987. Police said Runnels was a Flagstaff resident at the time of the crime. In 2001, Langstaff's mother appealed to readers of the Arizona Daily Sun for any information that might help bring closure in her daughter's case. At that point, it had already been more than a decade since Langstaff's murder. Police told the Daily Sun that year that they continued to build a case against a prime suspect, but no charges were filed until now, 25 years later. Ina's family has waited nearly four decades for answers, Coconino County Attorney Ammon Barker stated in a press release. Our office, in partnership with the Flagstaff Police Department, has worked diligently to follow the evidence and take this important step toward justice for Ms. Langstaff, her family, and our community. According to the information released Tuesday, new DNA testing conducted by the Arizona Department of Public Safety's Northern Regional Crime Laboratory last year was pivotal to the case. The police department said the tests provided critical confirmation of the subject's or suspect's connection. This development reflects decades of perseverance by investigators, continued advancements in forensic science, and strong collaboration among law enforcement agencies, the department stated in a press release. The Flagstaff Police Department remains steadfast in its commitment to seeking justice for victims and their families, regardless of how much time has passed. The department also thanked Langstaff's family for their unwavering dedication and determination in their pursuit of justice for Ina. The Coconino County Attorney's Office announced the formal establishment of a cold case unit last year, but efforts to seek indictments and convictions in cold cases predate that action. In 2020, a 60-year-old Arizona man pleaded guilty in Coconino County Superior Court after being charged with sexual assault from a 2003 incident. In 2015, county prosecutors brought 34-year-old murder case to trial here, but a jury ultimately acquitted the suspect. The Coconino County Sheriff's Office has had a cold case unit since 2005, staffed primarily by volunteers. That unit maintains a list of major cold cases in Flagstaff and Coconino County, dating back to the late 1950s. If prosecutors secure a conviction against Runnels, one case could finally be checked off that list. No information about Runnels' future court appearances or legal representation was immediately available. Anyone with additional information related to the case is encouraged to contact the Flagstaff Police Department at 928-774-1414 or Silent Witness at 928-774-6111. And that front page article was titled Glendale Man Charged with Murder in Decades-Old Flagstaff Cold Case. And it was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. And now for our third front page story. We have an article under the banner Community titled Family Members Tip Their Hats to Late Flagstaff Legend Tony Norris. And this article was written by Calliope J. Ludeker, Sun staff reporter. Just beyond the Norris family home, the meadows of Doney Park stretch unbroken toward the horizon. Beneath the warm March sunset, it is not difficult to imagine local legend Toni Morris strumming his guitar on a summer afternoon, his wife Sue tending to the garden as their children run wild among the pines. Now all adults, three generations, gather in the familiar living room, sharing tender memories of the man they knew. Toni died on February 20th, survived by his wife, four children, two children-in-laws, and eight grandchildren. He was preceded in death by one son. "It's been a very busy old house," Sue said. "We're very bonded." Toni and Sue first arrived in 1983. Back then, few other residences dotted the landscape, their backyard an endless expanse of nature. The children traded spaces all around the two-story structure over the years. Many, including the grandchildren, found their way back home later in life. "We all kind of took turns living here," said Ruth Norris Thomas, one of Toni's daughters. Toni was born in Texas on April 12, 1950, the seventh son of 11 children. He developed an affinity for cowboy culture early in life. As a storyteller and avid reader, the niche of cowboy lore fit him like a glove. Talent ran rampant through Toni's family tree. His uncle was a member of 1930s country swing band Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. As such, his upbringing never lacked in art or music. "He didn't know how to read music. He could just jump into any jam," Sue said. "He was an ad-libber, but also had a structure he built of stories leading into songs." The couple met in 1969 at the Heathcote School of Living in Freeland, Maryland. The school operated as a commune, with its residents learning to be sustainable and live off the land. Toni brought his musical prowess to the table, picking up the folk songs of Appalachia from his colleagues. "We were what was kindly referred to as hippies," Sue said. "We had music every night. It's how Toni grew as a musician. He didn't want big venues. He wanted to be close to people. He had a great relationship with his audiences." Toni and Sue went on to become homesteaders in West Virginia before marrying in 1975. "Some of my best memories of Toni are with these old hillbillies, learning the skills and how to work with horses. It was a time of experimentation," Sue said. We were reminiscing a couple of weeks before he died. "It was a high point for memory making because it was so outrageous. We didn't have electricity or running water. We were camped half the time." Toni delivered all of their children at home. Sue would stay home with the family, while Toni dabbled in a number of unfortunate trades, from shoeing horses to mucking around in the blood pit of a packing plant. Eventually, an opportunity in telecommunications brought the family to Flagstaff, where a company bankruptcy resulted in Toni losing his 401k. "He was just scraping by to make a living for our growing family," Sue said. "He was industrious. He had his hands in so many places and found ways to monetize," Ruth said, noting the impact of watching her parents make ends meet. "We were raised to barter and trade. For my daughter to do gymnastics, I did their books." The family had limited means, but Tony and Sue never let that stand in their way. They found joy in simple moments, such as bringing their children to see newly installed ATM machines. Tony planned picnics at the library of every town they passed through. Ruth recalls her friends joining her on her birthday for rides through the car wash. When we were kids, my folks took us absolutely everywhere with them, she said. When Tony performed at the local KOA, he would bring his kids along. We didn't get to eat out much, so we were always excited. They would have a full-on barbecue and ice cream sundaes, Ruth said. They had a talent show, but we were the only ones who would perform. Later on, the family would join him on Saturday nights to clean the athletic club. It was cool because we got to use the jacuzzi, Ruth laughed. Tony also saw the value in taking pride in individuality, even if it meant not standing in line. Youngest daughter, Grace Norris, a self-proclaimed troublemaker, experienced this firsthand. He would get a call and make the trek to her elementary school, having her write apologies for her reactions. He told me in later years, every time I got that call, I was more and more proud you stood up for who you were and never caved to society's expectations, Grace said. He was very, very authentic and wanted everyone around him to be authentic, Sue added. Sue eventually returned to school to complete her master's degree. She began teaching at Flagstaff High School, allowing Tony the freedom to pursue entertaining professionally. He took up storytelling and playing music at the Grand Canyon Railway and elder hostels. All the way, he continued to rope family members into his gigs. Looking back on it, what stands out to me is how we were always a part of our parents' lives. We didn't even think twice about all five of us going to a gig with my dad, Ruth said. He was always unbelievably present. He took us with him and made us a part of everything he was doing. Grace remembers joining him on the Verde Canyon Railway, sometimes lugging his gear like a tiny roadie. I had my own little cowboy getup. I would go perform with him and he would split his tips with me, Grace said. I was his sidekick a lot of the time. We all got an instrument at one point or another, said Ruth's daughter, Carrie Joy Thomas. He was really trying to make a band. Tony and Sue owned a cabin in San Felipe, Mexico, overlooking Cantu Cove. There, Tony kicked off the San Felipe Folk Festival and encouraged his children to take part. We'd spend hours walking up and down the beach writing our own songs, Carrie Joy said. They didn't have to be good. I'm sure 80% of them weren't. No matter what it looked like, he cheered us on. He encouraged us beyond belief to express ourselves in any form. He loved it. He wanted people to create and express themselves however it looked for them, said Keely Aldridge, daughter of eldest sister Leah Norris. He was relentless in fostering our expression. It shows up everywhere. Tony's very being seemed to inspire all those around him. He was able to get dusty instruments into the hands of those well beyond their musical days. Some of them would go on to become seasoned artists. He had a gift bringing music out of people. I watched it for all those years, Sue said. It was amazing how he would encourage people and they'd do it. Even near the very end, at the Peaks, I would come in to somebody cleaning his room and singing him a lullaby in Navajo, Grace added. Carrie Joy agreed, pointing out, even when she lacked confidence in her own abilities, Tony emphasized skill was not what was mattered. The value was in the expression and creativity. He's the only one who could get all of us to sing, she said. If we were singing with Grandpa, we were all in. My dad always told us, don't ever let not knowing how to do something stop you from doing it, Ruth added. If any of us kids ever expressed the slightest interest in a music or art form, it was automatically in our hands. Same thing with the grandkids. Tony's most recent Christmas wish was for all of the grandkids to sit together. Ruth printed off copies of the extensive songbook Tony wrote and illustrated in his 30s, binding it with recycled string in true Norris fashion. The family spent over 2 hours singing together. The unconditional love he gave exists so strongly within our family. I think it's also part of his strength in the community, Carrie Joy said. Nothing you could do or say could affect it. He wanted us to be us and be loved for who we are. I never wondered if my parents loved me, Ruth said. She recalls, as an adolescent, seeing a chili pepper skirt in a shop window while venturing around downtown with her father one holiday season. She was entranced by the skirt. We didn't have a lot of money, so we couldn't get a lot of things, Ruth said, tears building behind her eyes. He remembered. On Christmas, he stayed up all night long and sewed me the skirt. The family remembers holidays as an open invitation, and newcomers were consistently joining the festivities. Friends, community members, and even exes were welcomed in with open arms. Tony saw every individual as someone worthy of love. No memory exemplifies this more than one family road trip when Tony, a notorious scavenger, stopped the car to retrieve a backpack from the side of the road. To everyone's surprise, the backpack was attached to a very dehydrated man. Without a second thought, Tony tossed him into the back seat and drove him to town. He saw people, and people are so rarely seen that when someone does, it's really impactful. It made such a huge impact on me, Ruth said. He just had such a big heart, and so does my mom. Tony made countless contributions to the Flagstaff community. To name a few, he founded the Northern Arizona Storytellers, co-founded Flagstaff Friends of Traditional Music, FFOTM, produced the CAF radio program Under Western Skies, collaborated with Greg Hale to produce Flagstaff Letter from Home, and kick-started the Poor Medical Clinic's Beans and Rice fundraiser. A celebration of life will take place at the Orpheum Theater on Sunday, March 29th from 2 to 5 p.m. on what would have been his 51st wedding anniversary with Sue. Musicians who have played with Tony will put on a performance followed by a sharing of memories. Donations can be made in Tony's name to FFOTM's Young Jammers program or Poor Medical Clinic. Tony's life will be remembered by those who knew him as one lived to the fullest. Life was play. It was to be enjoyed, Carrie Joy said. He made every experience into the coolest thing you could be doing. And that community article was titled Flagstaff Members Tip Their Hats to Late Flagstaff Legend Tony Norris, and it was written by Calliope J. Ludeker. And just a reminder that you're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. You can also get our stream and on-demand programs with Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android devices. Now we're going to move forward a couple pages to page A3, and we're going to read some news briefs. The first one is titled, California Man Charged with Child Sex Offenses in Coconino County. And it's written by Daily Sun staff, as I believe are all of these briefs. A 30-year-old California resident was arrested by the Coconino County Sheriff's Office last week after a grand jury charged him with two sexual offenses involving a minor. Devin Cole Parnum was booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility on the afternoon of Tuesday, March 17th. The indictment against Parnum alleges that in November 2025, he engaged in sexual conduct with a minor under 15 years of age, defined by law as sexual intercourse or oral sexual contact. That offense is a Class 2 felony. The indictment also alleges Parnum committed sexual molestation of a child, defined as knowing or intentional sexual contact with a minor younger than 15, also a Class 2 felony. The two charged offenses relate to the same alleged victim, and both are alleged to be dangerous crimes against children, a designation that carries stricter sentencing requirements if the defendant is convicted. No additional information about the circumstances of the alleged offenses was yet available. Jail records show that Parnum posted a $25,000 cash bond on Friday, March 20th, and was released from custody. The Coconino County Superior Court ordered Parnum not to travel outside of his home state of California, except for court appearances in Arizona. The release order also stated, no contact with victim at all, no Snapchat. Parnum has retained Flagstaff attorney Bruce Griffin to represent him in court. His next court appearance was scheduled for mid-April. And that brief was called California Man Charged with Child Sex Offenses. Our next news brief is called Woman Arrested in Flagstaff After Allegedly Starting Brush Fire. The Flagstaff Police Department arrested a woman on Saturday who allegedly started a fire on undeveloped land between Huntington Drive and Interstate 40. Kiara Shanae Lane, 26, was booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility on suspicion of reckless burning and burning of wild lands, both misdemeanors. Lane was also accused of misdemeanor trespassing. As of Monday morning, there was no record yet of any court appearance by Lane, who remained in jail custody. The Flagstaff Fire Department was able to quickly contain and extinguish the fire. No additional information was immediately available. Next brief is called Coconino County Confirms First Measles Case of 2026. Coconino County Health and Human Services, CCHHS, confirmed the first positive case of measles for a resident in 2026 on March 20th. CCHHS officials are working with the state and local partners to notify individuals who are exposed to the illness, with confirmed locations and times of exposure, including Page High School on March 12th, Safeway on Elm Street in Page in the afternoon on March 12th, and Banner Page Hospital from 12:40 to 5:20 p.m. on March 16th. Individuals who were at these three locations during the dates and times could have been exposed and should monitor for any signs or symptoms of the illness for 21 days after exposure. Symptoms typically appear 7 to 12 days after exposure, but may take up to 21 days. Symptoms include a high fever greater than 101 degrees, cough, feeling run down and achy, red and watery eyes, runny nose, and a blotchy rash, which usually starts on the face before extending down the body. Two doses of the MMR vaccine are recommended by doctors as the best way to protect against measles, mumps, and rubella, starting with the first dose at 12 to 15 months of age and the second dose at 4 through 6 years of age. Teens and adults should also be up to date on their MMR vaccination. Anyone experiencing any symptoms of measles should self-isolate and stay away from others. Additionally, individuals should contact their healthcare provider by phone. Let them know you are concerned you may have measles. They will provide instructions for you to visit their office at a time that will not risk exposing others. If you do not have a healthcare provider and need to seek care, contact urgent care or hospital by phone before visiting and let them know that you suspect measles. Contact your healthcare provider or call the CCHHS Health and Wellness Clinic at 928-679-7222 to schedule an MMR vaccination. And here we also have on this page an article called City's Case Against Desert Mountain Might Change Courts by Sam McLaughlin, Sun Staff reporter. The latest wrinkle in the years-long saga of litigation between the City of Flagstaff and Desert Mountain Energy Corp is a potential change of venue, as the company filed a notice of removal on Thursday, March 12th, asking to transfer the city's second lawsuit from Coconino County Superior Court to the U.S. District Court for the District of Arizona. In their filing, attorneys for Desert Mountain said the federal court has the authority to hear the case under the rule of diversity jurisdictions. The parties are from different states. The corporation is technically organized under the laws of Nevada, with its principal place of business in British Columbia, Canada. And the amount of money in dispute exceeds $75,000. However, both of those things were also true when the city filed its original lawsuit in 2020. It was thus not immediately clear why Desert Mountain's attorneys filed for removal only in the second case. Tyler H. Stanton of the firm DeConcini, McDonald, Yetwin, and Lacey, P.C., representing Desert Mountain, did not respond to a request for comment. The federal court filing Stanton signed avows that the removal action is not intended to cause unnecessary delay or needlessly increase the cost of litigation. The current Flagstaff City Council authorized the second lawsuit against Desert Mountain in February of this year. The city's original lawsuit from December 2020 was declared null and void by the Arizona Court of Appeals in March 2025 because the past city council did not properly ratify the decision to sue in a public forum. Coconino County Superior Court Judge Charles Dowdy ruled earlier this month that the city could not revive its original complaint in that first lawsuit. His ruling came after the city had already initiated its new case. The city filed a motion to consolidate the old and new cases on March 10th, but proceedings in Superior Court are stayed for the moment. It is possible for the federal court to remand the case back to the Superior Court. Broadly speaking, federal courts hold a strong presumption against removal and usually interpret uncertainty or ambiguity of jurisdiction in favor of the remand. The city has 30 days from March 12th to file a motion for remand. As of Monday, March 23rd, the city's attorneys had not yet filed any motion or response in the U.S. District Court. And that article was titled, City's Case Against Desert Mountain Might Change Courts. And it was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Next, we'll move on to a page where there are a number more news briefs about local and regional issues. It looks like they're all written by Daily Sun staff, but Abigail Kessler has a credit at the end of the article. Weekly prescribed fire plans modified due to weather. The Coconino National Forest announced modified plans for multiple prescribed fires due to the unseasonably warm and dry weather. The Flagstaff Urban Interface Mount Eldon, Campbell Mesa, and Mountain Air projects are listed and will be updated on InciWeb at inciweb.wildfire.gov. West Fork Crater Sinks. Located 13 miles southwest of Flagstaff, the 1,441-acre broadcast burn is now planned for Thursday, March 26th, depending on the conditions. Smoke impacts could occur during the early ignition phase of the burn and will decrease as smoke begins to disperse to the northeast. Smoke might impact Arizona State Route 89 to the east of the project and settle overnight in the surrounding area during the evenings and early mornings. Bar M, planned for two separate blocks, 1.5 miles west of Mormon Lake and the other 5 miles southeast of Mormon Lake. The 2,300 acres are planned to be burned from March 27th to 31st, depending on the conditions. The Arizona National Scenic Trail southwest of the Mormon Lake community may be rerouted. The broadcast burn could create smoke impacts during the active ignition phase, with possible impacts to Lake Mary Road and the Mormon Lake community. Smoke is expected to rise and disperse to the northeast. Smoke production is expected to decrease overnight, but could settle in around surrounding areas. Blue Ridge Urban Interface, BRUI. A total of 700 acres will be burned 13.5 miles northeast of Clint's Well, just north of the Starlight Pines neighborhood. Depending on conditions, the one-day burn could begin on March 26th, 27th, or 28th. Smoke might impact Arizona State Route 87 adjacent to the burn, as well as communities directly to the south. Fanning Wash stormwater improvements to begin in April. The City of Flagstaff announced Monday that work to improve a section of the Fanning Wash Channel between East Linda Vista Drive and North Steves Boulevard will begin in April, weather permitting. According to the city's press release, the planned work includes vegetation and tree removal, as well as slope and channel enhancements to increase the channel's capacity and reduce flood risk to the surrounding area. Eagle Mountain Construction is the contractor for the project. Work will take place on weekdays between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. No road closures are anticipated, but there could be intermittent lane, sidewalk, and trail restrictions on Linda Vista Drive and/or Steves Boulevard until the work is completed. The project should be finished this summer, the city stated, but the date of completion will depend on weather conditions in the coming months. Additional improvements to Fanning Wash are planned in future years. For questions or additional information about the current project, please contact the project hotline at 928-255-5153. Next news brief is called Wild and Scenic Film Festival Makes Return at MNA. Excuse me. For the 15th year, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival on Tour will return to the Museum of Northern Arizona, MNA, to benefit the Grand Canyon Wolf Recovery Project, GCWRP. Scheduled for Saturday, May 28th, the annual festival will feature 12 short films, along with a silent auction, raffle prizes, and refreshments, including snacks, wine, and beer. The doors will open at 6 p.m., with films scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. The festival serves as the GCWRP's largest fundraiser and biggest community outreach event. The film lineup for 2026 includes stories from around the world, including polar bears in the Canadian tundra, elephant conservation in Kenya, otter detection dogs in Wales, and the Los Angeles Cougar P22, as the films explore what it looks like when people and wildlife share spaces, and how communities can move away from conflict and toward care. One of the featured short films, titled Bears in Hot Tubs, features a suburban black bear named Maddie and her kin in Los Angeles. The film formally recognizes Maddie as a co-director, and it recently won Best Short Documentary at the Lady Face Mountain Film Festival. Tickets are available at gcwolfrecovery.org. For those unable to attend in person, GCWRP will also offer a video on demand option to allow supporters to participate from home. The virtual film program will be available from March 28th through April 3rd. For more information, contact Claire Musser, Executive Director of the GCWRP, at Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E, at wolfrecovery.org or 928-202-1325. Next up, and this is the brief that's attributed to Abigail Kessler, Sun staff reporter, is called Ponderosa Hacks, hosting free high school hackathon. Ponderosa Hacks will be hosting a hackathon for Flagstaff middle and high school students in March, creating are featuring a creative problem-solving challenge and STEM skills workshops. This year's hackathon will be on Saturday, March 28th, at Basis Flagstaff from 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. The group's president and event organizer, Nolan Takeuchi, said any local middle or high schooler is welcome to register to take part, regardless of their experience with technology. We're trying to expand what high schoolers and middle schoolers can do with technology to really improve innovation and use teamwork so they can create unique solutions to the different types of problems, said Takeuchi, who is a junior at Basis Flagstaff. On the day of the hackathon, students will be given a real-world problem for which they have to devise a solution in teams. They can take really any sort of lens they want on it, he said, explaining that the solutions, for example, could be technological, artistic, or based in healthcare or the humanities. The teams will pitch their solutions to the judges to win prizes at the end of the day. The day will also feature workshops designed to teach participants skills related to the mechanics, engineering, and coding. This year's workshops will cover 3D printing, the circuitry that controls electronics and coding basics. Last year's prompt was to create defenses after crash landing on an alien planet. Takeuchi said the one for this year was designed to be more grounded, though the specifics of the challenge will be kept secret until the day of the event. I want to make it so that students feel like if they wanted to, they could take this idea and turn it into something real, he said of this year's challenge. I hope that they will be able to make projects and take that into the community and be like, hey, this is something I could make in real life. And I hope to expand STEM education for people around Flagstaff and around Northern Arizona. Sponsors for Ponderosa Hacks this year include EmberSafe Communities, Findlay Toyota, Evans Group Law, Northern Arizona Radiology, and Northern Arizona University. More information about the hackathon, including how to register, is available at ponderosa-hacks.com. And then it looks like the final news brief on this page is called Flagstaff's Downtown Library Getting New Windows by Daily Sun staff. A window replacement project at the Flagstaff City, Coconino County Public Library on Aspen Avenue in downtown Flagstaff began Monday, March 23rd. After years of saving plus assistance from the City of Flagstaff, we are replacing our leaking broken seal windows, an informational post on the library website said. The project is set to occur in 4 stages with as limited interruption in service as we can manage. No estimated completion date was provided. The downtown library will remain open, but scheduled programming may be impacted, and 6 parking spaces on the northeast side of the library will be taken up by construction materials. For those who are sensitive to dust or noise, the East Flagstaff Community Library on 4th Street will also remain open this time, and any holds from the downtown location can be sent there for pickup. Questions can be directed to Emily Kane at ecain@flagstaffpubliclibrary.org. And those were more local Flagstaff news briefs. And moving on, we're going to finish today's Arizona Daily Sun by reading some of Dear Abby. It's titled, Aunt's Passing is Followed by a Bitter Falling Out. Dear Abby, my favorite aunt was dying. Her daughter is my favorite cousin, so I texted her almost every day with encouragement. When the doctor said the end was near, I backed off messaging to give the family space to themselves. 13 days later, I received a text with a photograph of my aunt's grave. Ensuing texts and phone calls indicated that my cousin's older brother had grandstanded and taken over. Questions about her service and burial went unanswered. I expressed dismay. Our family had been the first to call about almost everything. I have read a great deal about forgiveness, when to offer it, and when to forgive the messenger but not the action. That is the stance I have taken. My once beloved cousin responds as if all is well between us, though she has asked twice if I would rather stop communicating, given that I rarely respond. Twice I have said that is up to you. Admittedly, I would love some closure on this one way or the other. In my youth, I would have forgiven it all, probably even apologized for her pain while subjugating my own. I am not in that frame of mind now. Do I forgive, forget, move on? And it's signed Bewildered in Florida. Here's Abby's answer. Dear Bewildered, what happened was not your cousin's fault. The fault lies with her grandstanding brother. Do not allow this to interfere with your formerly loving relationship with her. By all means, forgive and move on. Also, put aside your passive-aggressive attitude. When people are grieving a death, even one that is expected, they are usually distracted, in pain, and not thinking about how their actions affect others. And that was the article or column, Dear Abby. And now I have to tell you that's all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun today. For Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. Take care.